Welcome to this bonus episode, in which you'll be hearing a keynote lecture from the event Women Intellectuals in Antiquity. It was held at Keble College, Oxford, in February 2020, and organized by Ursula Koop, Catherine O'Reilly, Jenny Rallins, and myself. Funding was received from Keble College, Oxford, the British Society for the History of Philosophy, the Oxford Research Centre in the Humanities, Oxford University, the Department of Classics at King's College London, and the LMU in Munich. In this talk, you'll be hearing Sophia Connell of Birkbeck College London speaking on the topic, Women's Medical Knowledge in Antiquity Beyond Midwifery.
The intellectual dimension of women's lives in antiquity is somewhat hidden from us. It would be difficult to imagine that women of this period did not use their intellects and construct theories. This is particularly the case when it comes to a field of study which would have been close to the fabric of their lives. Knowledge about their own health and fertility. This paper will attempt to argue that women's medical expertise was reasonably widespread in classical antiquity. Gathering the evidence for this is fraught with difficulties. There are no extant writings by women doctors. It's not clear that they ever wrote anything at all. We are thus left with two unsatisfactory options in order to discover more about their medical expertise. As Helen King explains in her book, Hippocrates as a Woman, there are either arguments from silence or what doctors say about women's knowledge. Despite the difficulties with inferring anything using either method, we have no option but to employ both. Plato and Aristotle also provide useful clues about what women knew about the body and health. The investigation into women's medical knowledge of this period yields two lines of inquiry. The first one concerns the nature of the knowledge held by women doctors. The second involves the content of that knowledge. I will give a brief description of each area before proceeding to a more detailed analysis. I will also seek to justify talking about women as doctors in this period rather than as nurses or midwives. With respect to the nature of knowledge, it's misleading to impose onto antiquity a more modern dichotomy between practically minded women practitioners on the one hand and intellectual male doctors on the other, or midwives and doctors or nurses and doctors. While there is certainly a distinction between male and female practitioners in this period, it didn't fall along these lines. It seems that both male and female doctors had aspects of theory as part of their practice and aspects that would seem to us more like nursing. This means that women doctors not only had technical expertise associated with healing, but also epistemic expertise, knowledge of the body and its workings on some theory or other, by which they made their practice comprehensible. The second line of inquiry isn't to what women doctors actually thought and the nature of their theories. Here, the method is almost entirely arguments from silence. Speculations that do not have explicit articulation in any text that survive. A picture can be reconstructed, however, of expertise not only into the female body and its functions and cycles, but the relation between female desire, sexuality, and fertility. Women with medical knowledge were those who were respected for their knowledge of the right mixtures that resulted in successful new people. A powerful key to understanding the workings of the continuous cycles of nature. Many of these cycles would have been strongly associated with time periods, the recordings of which women would have participated in from very early on. When people ceased to be fertile, when they started to be fertile, the timings of gestations, lactations, and births. Before I begin to look more closely at the nature and content of women's knowledge of medical matters, I must first justify the idea that there were female doctors in this period. A feminine version of the word for doctor, iatros, iatreusa, is employed in the period. There's also ample evidence that women medical practitioners didn't only deliver babies. Certain women were called maia, usually translated midwife. We learn more about their field of expertise from Plato, who has Socrates give an account of the skills displayed by his own mother, Phaenarate. Quote, moreover, by giving drugs and singing incantations, midwives can bring on the pains of labor and make them milder if they want to. And they can make women who are having a difficult labor give birth, And if they see fit to cause a miscarriage when the embryo is young, they do so. And have you also observed this characteristics of theirs? They're the cleverest of matchmakers in that there are no gaps in their wisdom as regards knowing which sort of woman should consort with which sort of man in order to produce the best possible children. This passage illustrates that even those medical women who specialized in delivering babies had a broader basis of practice and theory than modern midwives, such as administering drugs, causing abortions, being knowledgeable about theories of reproduction and aiding conception. We also have a piece of physical evidence about women doctors. A 4th-century funerary monument reads, "Phanostrate, a midwife and doctor, Iatros, lies here. She caused pain to none. All lamented her death." This shows that women's practice extended beyond the skills of a Maya. That women were considered to be doctors at the time is also supported by a passage in Plato's Republic, where Socrates argues that women can be rulers of the state. This is something his audience finds hard to imagine. In order to make it more palatable, he therefore has to begin with an acceptable female job. He says if a man and a woman can both be suited to be doctors, well, then they can both be suited to be cultured, warlike, philosophical, and so they can both be rulers of the state. The audience readily accepts that women are already doctors. Many scholars conclude from this evidence that it would have been the norm for women with ailments to call on women doctors. Why, you might wonder, would women need women doctors? The rationale for this is found throughout the Greek biomedical writings and very probably existed in the minds of practitioners well before it was written down. The general idea is that a woman's body retains excess blood, which must be voided periodically in order for her to be healthy. This blood can be used up on nourishing a fetus if she becomes pregnant and is converted into milk during lactation. The texture of the female body is much spongier and softer than the male one, which allows for the absorption of more fluid. The author of Diseases of Women, the retention of more blood is due to a woman being hotter than a man. The opposite is the case for Aristotle. It's due to the coldness of women that they have more residual blood. To ensure health, the doctor must help the female body to discharge the right quality and quantity of residue. If retained, it can cause disease and pain. So therapies concentrate on either bringing about regular menstruation or facilitating pregnancy, since pregnancy will use up this blood. Signs of health for women also include desire for and pleasure in sexual intercourse, and it is healthy for a woman to be sexually active. As the health of women on this model was thought of as quite fundamentally different from that of men, it made perfect sense to split medical expertise between the sexes. There is, however, a major complication. The texts which give us the most evidence for a separate discipline of female medicine also show that men are taking over or sharing in that knowledge by the time of the Hippocratic writings. The author of the Hippocratic work, Diseases of Women, hints that this appropriation is not yet widespread, noting that some male doctors still wrongly treat women's diseases as if they were the diseases of men. Doctors may err in not inquiring carefully about a disease's cause and in treating them like diseases in men. Indeed, I've seen many women perish in such cases. Rather, you must question a patient immediately and in detail about the cause, for there is a great difference in the treatment of women's diseases and those of men. What is described in these works is not like modern gynecology, a branch of medicine that concerns the female reproductive system. Instead, many illnesses affecting the rest of the body are taken to be connected to the patient's being a woman through two key mechanisms, the need to purge blood, as already mentioned, on the one hand, and the motility of the uterus on the other. Ailments that are treated by treating a woman's reproductive system include anything from head colds to leg pain. The general view expressed in the Hippocratic Places in Man that all parts of the body are connected and so one has to treat the whole body in order to treat any part of it is repeated in several pronouncements in Diseases of Women. So we can see how the theory is made to fit with doctrines found in other parts of the Hippocratic corpus. This idea of treating the whole body, humoral theory as well, classifications of human types of human being, and the general views about regimen that you must try and dry a body that's too moist or moisten a body that's too dry. But there are also aspects to the recommendations found in these works that occur nowhere else in the Hippocratic corpus. These texts contain extensive lists of ingredients or recipes and instructions for how to employ these in curing a woman or maintaining her health. Another argument from silence, but one it would be hard to refute, is that much of this practice and some of the theory behind it will have come from women healers. These female doctors must have been party to an extensive oral tradition passed on through many generations, which existed before male medical writers put them onto the page for the male audience. There is ample evidence that male doctors are not entirely in control. Taking on the knowledge of peculiarly female complaints is a tricky business. The information required comes from women. For example, the male doctor is instructed to find out from women about the timings of their cycles and the consistency of their discharges. Almost all references to examination of the cervix use the female participle. Although these Hippocratic works sometimes place the male doctor at center stage, they also show that women are still partly in charge. Women themselves are said to know about their own bodies and to cooperate in and even initiate the treatments. The woman applies most of the medicines on her own, sometimes as instructed by a doctor. For instance, the quote, have the patient draw the cervix aside with a finger, have her remove the suppository, etc. In one case, the woman involved, after independent internal self-examination, actually discovers her own ailment and reports this to the doctor. There are various mentions of women doctors being present when the male doctor is attending on women. At another point, the male medical writer recommends picking and choosing from the women doctor's medications. Try the medicines of the women and have the patient take the most appropriate one. In these ways, women's own knowledge and experience is evident in these works. Moving on to the nature of women's medical knowledge. One sometimes comes across the idea that male doctors, and particularly those who wrote about their bodies, wrote about their theories of the body and health, are similar to modern professional doctors, whereas women doctors are the equivalent of folk healers without any rational basis for their practice. One must be cautious about applying that dichotomy to male and female practitioners who attended on women. The first problem is that medicine is not professionalized at this time. Certain medical texts advise on how the male doctor must present himself as knowledgeable and show that he can cure, or at least he has to convince people that he can cure them. Since the methods were primitive, this performance of being a doctor with a cure would have been crucial. And this being part of medical practice at the time means that both genders of doctor would have had to do this kind of performance. They would have had to present themselves as knowledgeable in order to convince their clientele. In fact, in the case of curing women what ails them because they are women, it would have been harder for male practitioners to convince their patients to trust their knowledge. The female practitioner will add to her theory and her practice the knowledge she has of her own bodily experiences. Plato uses this well-known fact in his discussion of medical expertise in women in order to pronounce that human nature is too weak to acquire skills in matters of which it has no experience. Another problem is that the texts we have are by men who have an interest in presenting women doctors in a negative light, so as to convince their clientele of their own superior knowledge. And so we can't trust the accusations of quackery we find there. For example, when the author of Diseases of Women remarks that the medicines of women are irritating. This is in the context of them as competitors for the client's attention. And now I'm going to discuss another more complicated case where doctors pit themselves against women theorists on the relation between fetal health and the length of gestation. Women hold the view that stillborns occur at 8 months of gestation. One Hippocratic author questions the veracity of their reports about this timing. Quote, You should not distrust women about their giving birth, for they always say the same thing, and they always say what they know. They are not to be persuaded by either fact or argument to believe anything contrary to what they know is going on inside their own bodies. Although there may be some who wish to assert something different, in fact, women who possess judgment and who furnish the most convincing arguments on the subject always say explicitly that they give birth in the 7th month, the 8th month, the 9th month, the 10th month, and the 11th month, and that of these children, those born in the 8th month do not survive, whereas the others do. The passage begins disparagingly in suggesting that women are intuitive creatures who don't listen to fact or argument. However, it ends with the thought that there are women of judgment who convincingly argue for their theories. The Hippocratic author proclaims, with some notable caution, that these women are wrong, that only 8-month fetuses suffer in this way, because there are some fetuses on either side, some in the 7th month and some in the 8th, 9th month, that are also in danger. This doctor is quibbling the details, but generally accepts the correctness of this woman's theory. So that isn't any proof, in any case, that male rational doctors are arguing against irrational traditional beliefs that come from women. In any case, there are plenty of incorrect or irrational beliefs in these texts, which are accepted or invented, and sometimes the male writers seem to take them to extremes. One example is the theory that fetuses fight their way out of the womb. On the basis of this view, it's recommended that women be strapped to beds and ladders, bounced up and down during difficult labor. Elsewhere, the male doctors recommend tying up one or other testicle in order to determine the sex of offspring. It's clear in these instances and others that the theories associated with what women say are often no more arbitrary or folklorish than any others we find here. So there isn't any trustworthy testimony that women did not have a theory in practice just as viable as any others at the time. In considering the nature of medical knowledge, it's helpful to turn to what Aristotle says about what doctors know. In the first book of the Metaphysics, he distinguishes between experience, empyrēia, and technical knowledge, techne, using a helpful medical example. Experience is judging what would benefit a particular person, such as Callicles, who suffers from a disease. Technical knowledge is to understand what benefits all persons of a certain type who suffer from certain sorts of disease. Women practitioners who were called on to treat any number of different women and would have had to apply a general theory of what ailed them. Thus, both male and female doctors, indeed anyone who treats a number of people, will have that kind of technical knowledge. Aristotle also explains that those with technical knowledge in general know the theory, ton logon, and the causes, tas aitias. And so they will also be in possession of theoretical knowledge, episteme. A key sign of this is the ability to teach others. Women doctors evidently passed on their knowledge from one generation to the next. Thus, they would have been able to teach each other and would have had this sort of theoretical knowledge according to Aristotle's description. In the ancient context then, the thought that Hippocratic doctors are scientific or rational, whereas women healers only use folklore and tradition, is out of place. Another anachronistic set of assumptions about women healers is influenced by the development of male obstetric medicine in the early modern period. The thought here is that women doctors are midwives who are only in charge of normal births, while male doctors are brought in to deal with any complications. This is more or less how modern medicine operates and is a legacy of division that began earlier on. But it is not a correct way to understand ancient practices. Women practitioners are noted to be present at quite a few of the male interventions detailed in the Hippocratic corpus. Meanwhile, male medical writers would have had access to normal births. Socrates says that medical women are able to deal with difficult births through to the end, and certainly before the encroachment of men into the domain of obstetrics, they would have had to try. Aristotle states of the female doctor that she must be, quote, not only be able to help over difficult births with her dexterity, but she must also be quick-witted in dealing with contingencies. In any case, there's no reason to assume that men had come up with some of the life-saving procedures detailed in the Hippocratic writings, in particular, the extraction of a dead fetus and the turning of babies being born in awkward positions. Many of these techniques must have been taken over from women doctors' practices, since these women initially had the expertise involved through oral tradition and their experience of assisting in birth. Indeed, this may be the reason why, in Diseases of Women, Book 2, the author makes clear that during a procedure in which two men are present, it's the woman doctor that removes the fetus and the placenta. Moving on to the speculative content of women's medical knowledge. As mentioned already, we have no guide written for women by women doctors who specialized in the knowledge of their own ailments. This means that we have no direct evidence of what exactly women knew or professed to know or theorized as the basis of their practice. However, I will now speculate about the content of their knowledge in these four key areas. First, experience. Second, a theory of the body. Third, pharmacology. And fourth, theories of reproduction. The general technique in this section is to put forward a series of arguments from silence in order to conclude that much of the information we find in works by men about women's medicine ultimately came from women. This simply has to be the case with the very intimate matters such as the frequency and duration of menstruation, and also subjective perspectives, such as what it feels like to become pregnant, what it feels like to experience female sexual desire or pleasure. These facts make up a good part of the data in these texts. At times, the male writers say explicitly that such information comes from women, and it does not seem a stretch to think that there were certain women in the community who were known to have special knowledge of collective experiences of women. And there's evidence for this in Aristotle's Historia Animalium, Book 9. This is not a medical work, but a collection of information useful for the development of scientific explanations. The information listed is on human generation, and it contains a great deal about women's experiences of their cycles, conception, and pregnancy. Aristotle refers to women in the plural throughout, the women. Although this information could have come from women in his household, it is just as likely to have come from women experts. That possibility is strengthened when immediately after this section, Aristotle gives several technical terms which he notes are, quote, what the women call them. First of all is the amniotic fluid, what the women call the forerunner. And then the excrement of newborns, which the women call meconium. Extraordinarily, this is still the name we give it today. When Aristotle talks of information from the women here, I take it that he's referring to a number of women experts across different communities who hold this sort of information. Another aspect of this women's collective knowledge is their experiences of sex, as detailed in Pseudo-Aristotle, Historia Animalium, Book 10, which we will be discussing in the final part of the paper. When it comes to women's own experiences, these are not mere first-hand accounts, but theories based on shared information of female experience. Recall that Aristotle defined medicine as a techne, on the basis of the ability to specify types of people who suffer from certain ailments. He further specifies that this knowledge counts as theoretical knowledge when the holder of it can teach another. The Hippocratic author of On Fleshes, in discussing signs of pregnancy, explicitly acknowledges his debt to the teachings of women, writing, "It is to the extent that these women have instructed me that I know about these things." Number two, theory of the body. Given that male doctors are taking over the treatment and care of women's ailments, it's improbable that they came up with an entirely new set of theories of the female body, distinct from those which already formed the basis of many of the treatments recorded. Men may have adapted and changed these theories somewhat, or attempted to incorporate other aspects of their own theories. However, it's a fair assumption that the basic picture of how women's reproductive systems and interconnected body parts operated was already in place by the time male doctors began to encroach. The basic account focuses on the flow of fluids in the body and the stability of the uterus for health. It may be that women were the first to think of the uterus as motile. Indeed, the cervix can be felt to recede and move down, and this often coincides with certain parts of the menstrual cycle. Women also may experience uterine prolapse. Some recommended procedures are based on the view that the uterus is attracted to pleasant smells and retreats from unpleasant smells. Using information from women in Historia Animalium, Book 10, Pseudo-Aristotle says that the uterus can be thirsty. This idea of uterine agency could have originated with women doctors to justify their practices, or it could have been developed by male doctors. The theory of the uterus as sentient may strike us as odd, but for the ancients, it had a certain logic. Both Plato and Aristotle considered the penis to be like a separate little animal with a mind of its own. To this, Plato adds that the uterus travels the body in his Timaeus. As for the maintenance of health through regular menstruation, it may well be that women's collective experience gave a certain idea that this was the case, and that they were able to judge that healthy women had regular periods, and those that were ill or emaciated had amenorrhea and may have been infertile. And since only women have these regular discharges of blood-like fluid, and they also gestate and lactate, health was quite sensibly considered by women to require some kind of regular flow of materials around their bodies. Some have felt that the theories about women's health found in the Hippocratic works reveal only male concerns, since they often focus on fertility and recommend sex and pregnancy as cures. But it's very possible, indeed, I would argue probable, that fertility was a top priority in the minds of women of this period. Women's province was care of the home and the family. Bringing into the world healthy children would have brought them prestige and the sort of power accorded to women at this time. Within the Hippocratic texts, it's evident that women still held the main epistemic authority around these events. As the author of Diseases of Women remarks, it requires much attention and knowledge, episteme, to bring a child to term and provide for its nourishment in the uterus, and then to give birth to it. The knowledge of how to give birth to a child could only be something a woman could have. Pharmacology. The Hippocratic writings on women have more recipes in them than the entire rest of the corpus combined. It's implausible to suppose that men came up with all of these on their own when they thought to treat women. The practices around these recipes and their applications, orally, but often also vaginally, using various methods such as suppository and fumigations, these must have come, at least partially, from women doctors. The expertise in mixing and applying these drugs remained a woman's work. There's a tendency to classify the administration of drugs as less scientific or rational or more folklorish than other practices, such as dietetics. But there isn't any strong case for this in my mind. In fact, there's evidence that some of the medicines employed would have been effective, particularly those which would have caused miscarriage, like pennyroyal. The medicines that we cannot find any active ingredients in would have been no more ineffective than some of the other dietary recommendations and physical manipulations listed. In terms of the performance aspect of the cure, so important at this time, the prescription and administration of drugs were powerful sources of reassurance to patients. The recipes in these works by men are more like lists of ingredients, and so are only an indication of the pharmacological practice. A practitioner with knowledge of the underlying rationale for the use of certain medicines would have had to take the lists and adapt them, and often find similar substitutes for certain ingredients. seems most likely that these lists were only indicative, and the procuring of ingredients and the mixing of drugs remained in the hands of the much more experienced women practitioners. Moving on then to the final section on knowledge of how reproduction works. And this, I would say, might be the closest we have to women's natural science in these texts. It seems probable that women doctors would have had some theory about how reproduction works, and particularly what is required for conception. If they were going to be in the business not only of delivering babies, but also helping women to become pregnant, they will need a way to theorize this as part of their practice. Importantly, women doctors would have been in a different position to men because they would have had their own and other women's direct experience to draw on, experiences of sex and conception. The medical texts that we have all agree, at least for the humankind, that sex and male ejaculation is necessary for conception. Many also note the need for parallel female seed, also produced during sex. Diseases of Women, the text which we've already seen to contain so much information from women themselves, is the one that most often mentions that in order for conception to take place, women need to feel desire for and pleasure in sex. The theory of two parallel seeds is most thoroughly explained in a work called On Generation, a Hippocratic work. This work posits that women always cease to feel pleasure as soon as a man does. This appears to be an account from a male perspective, making much use of the first person plural. It's all about what we as men experience. This is a quote from the work On Generation. A man's seed falling into the uterus extinguishes a woman's warmth and pleasure. In fact, a woman's pleasure and warmth leap up at the moment the seed falls into her uterus, but then ceases. Another medical text, the Pseudo-Aristotelian Historia Animalium, Book 10, is more woman-centered. This male author is careful to listen to women, noting particularly their experiences of erotic dreams. This medical theorist is dependent on is actually dependent on this testimony for his theory. At one point, providing the following caveat: if the women are telling the truth, which leads me to wonder, why would they lie about that? The theory of generation here is different from the one found in On Generation because it posits that women have their own rhythm. For if it is true that the woman too contributes to the seed and to the generation, plainly there is need of equal speed on both sides. Therefore, if he has completed quickly, well, she has hardly done so, for in most things women are slower. This is an impediment to conception. In this case, the theory that women contribute something parallel to what men do is based on a sympathetic experience in sex. This theory, which may have originated with some women, is disputed by Aristotle. The counter theory proposed by Aristotle also requires information from women about their own experiences. So Aristotle took seriously what some women told him, which is that they can become pregnant even when they feel no pleasure. So we can see how women's experience of desire and pleasure form part of these theories of reproduction. And we can also see how the nature of the female contribution is being debated at this time. And it appears that women are involved in this debate. It would be far too simplistic to imagine that the women of ancient Greece had only one theory of generation. Like men, they probably had many competing theories. Other portions of the Hippocratic corpus reveal women's concentration on retaining male seed and making sure the mouth of the uterus is facing in the right direction. While this is compatible with their contributing their own seed during sex, it doesn't require this. And some wise women, perhaps those who spoke to Aristotle, may have had another explanation of the way in which women contribute to generation. What they are likely to have agreed about, and which no right-minded scientist would deny, is that women provide a generative contribution in some form. Historia Animalium Book 10 tells the story of a woman who tries to prove this through a zoological experiment. Quote, "There was once a woman who, capturing some singing grasshoppers while they were still young, kept them to see what would occur. And when they had grown, they became pregnant spontaneously. It's clear from these things that every female contributes to the embryo, even if this is evident in only one type of animal." Here we seem to have a budding female scientist in classical antiquity. Unfortunately, Aristotle would come along and say that this conclusion was flawed because it rests on too few instances, a complaint he levels against many of his opponents. However, this provides some evidence that certain women were engaged in inquiring in a more general way about the natural basis for their theories. In the final section, I turn to some speculations about how women with medical knowledge may have contributed to theories about when and how best to become pregnant. The theory that women contribute a parallel seed has obvious practical applications in terms of matching the right men to the right women. Aristotle notes that it happens to many women and men that they cannot produce children in union with each other, but can when apart from each other, that is, with other partners. For the author of Historia Animalium 10 and his female influence theory, the problem in these cases is that the man and the woman do not keep the same pace in lovemaking and so don't ejaculate simultaneously. That male and female must in some sense be harmonious fits to that theory well, but it also fits to other theories. For instance, Aristotle, who thought that women contribute menstrual blood and male contributes semen, thought they had to be a correct or balanced relationship between those two fluids, a correct mixture. The idea that there must be this equal speed is only available in Historia Animalium Book 10. They are literally racing towards the finishing line at the same pace. It's noteworthy that keeping track of time periods was another sort of knowledge assigned to women in this period. It's women who are in charge of tracking the duration of menstrual cycles and who were most knowledgeable about the timings of gestation and birth. It may be with this ability to calculate time periods in mind that Plato associates midwifery with matchmaking in the Theaetetus. They are the cleverest of matchmakers in that there are no gaps in their wisdom as regards knowing which sort of woman should consort with which sort of man in order to produce the best possible children. While the thought that women doctors were actually matchmakers has been questioned, it is the case that matchmaking in the ancient world was undertaken exclusively by women, and so it looks to be another area of expertise assigned to them. This may be why Socrates' attempt to explain how he matches young interlocutors to sophists is so amusing. He's playing a feminine role, a source of great hilarity to the Greeks. While matching the right men with the right women may seem like a joke in the Theaetetus, it's treated with much more seriousness in the Republic. The rulers of Callipolis, who will combine the expertise of both men and women in their ranks, will be eugenic matchmakers. If and when knowledge of the correct measurements of time periods for matching and mating people, when that wanes, then the whole civilization will suffer a decline. Not only for plants that grow in the earth, but also for animals that live upon it, there is a cycle of bearing and barrenness for soul and body as often as the revolutions of their orbs come full circle. And when your guardians, missing this, bring together brides and bridegrooms unseasonably, the offspring will not be well-born or fortunate. By the time of Aristotle, who recommends consulting doctors and scientists about the best time for procreation, men had taken this on as part of their science as well. But it's still probable that women would have had to contribute their expertise about timings. What women will still be respected for many centuries is their knowledge of mixtures. We've already seen the importance of women's knowledge of mixing and blending medicines. and of how the combining of male and female that results in successful generation must involve harmonious mixture. Female expertise continues to hold sway in this area of skill in mixing. Later on in antiquity, when treatises on alchemy and pharmacology are attributed to women. In conclusion, my main argument, composed of many moving parts, has been that information from women doctors permeates male medical and biological writings and includes theoretical constructs. This is an area where female expertise and knowledge was held in some regard by male doctors and natural philosophers. In a culture in which a woman's word was worth much less than that of a man, it's striking that on the subject of medicine, women retained a certain authority, particularly surrounding drugs and fertility. Given how ubiquitous such medical concerns were, women's contributions in this field of inquiry were arguably more widespread than in any other area of intellectual activity in antiquity.